Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Dog and Duck Show. My name is Warren. I am the dog. And in this special edition, I am so excited to welcome back to the show my friend Tony Castricone, the voice of the Huskies, the play-by-play announcer since 2017. And Tony, wow, what a ride it has been. Welcome to the show. And give me a little bit of perspective about what these last six or so years have been like for you.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention it in that framing. 6 years. I mean, we've got 9 6-year seniors on this Husky football team that just celebrated senior day in the Apple Cup. And I was kind of, you know, framing their story as to, like, they have to have had as crazy of a college football career as anybody ever, you know. Yeah. A, just to have a 6-year career that used to be reserved for, like, extremely rare gray shirts, you know. They come in 2018, and you know, as true freshmen, they're part of a team that wins the Pac-12, goes to the Rose Bowl. In 2019, the coach they came to play for resigns, and Chris Peterson. 2020, COVID strikes. They can't be around anybody. They can't go to class. 2021, an enormously disappointing season with the loss to Montana. They go 4-8. Their coach gets fired. 2022, a new guy comes in. It's like, who's this guy? Our third coach in 5 years. And in 2023, here they are competing for a national championship, sitting at 12-0, going into the Pac-12 championship game against their bitter arch rival with the whole country watching now. I mean, they're not just a West Coast program anymore. They're a national program. And, you know, they're one win away, 60 good minutes away from it coming full circle to being back in the Rose Bowl potentially. So that's what the 6 years has been like for them. A lot of up and down, a lot of just unprecedented and unexpected things. And for me, it's been kind of the same. You know, I think there's a lot of joy in there. And, you know, it's hard to think of much more joy than right now. And then on the personal level, you know, we added a baby boy in 2021, and he's 2 now, and he knows how to say go dogs. And just this morning, he was reading a birthday card from his grandma, and completely on his own, not provoked at all by me, but he decided that he wanted to put stickers over every letter O in that card. And so he did. So I'm like, all right. He just knows. Hilarious. Like, the letter O does not fly in the Castricone house this week. So it's been a very blessed 6 years, I guess would be the best way of saying it. And you know, I don't think anybody covers that span of time without adversity and without hardships. And so that's baked in to existence, but overall just extremely blessed.
Absolutely. And I mean, you hit all the notes that I had written down related to that so well, Tony. And you know, that leads me to another question that I was going to ask you, and it's really related to your journey of being the play-by-play announcer for the Huskies. I know when you got here, you worked really, really hard to ingratiate yourself with the Husky community. You're very active on Twitter. You have done a great job of trying to familiarize yourself with every, you know, historical moment in this storied program. And yet at the same time, you didn't grow up in Seattle. You didn't grow up as a Husky fan. So when did you really begin to feel like, man, I am a Husky? Like, this is not just a job for me. I truly deeply care about, you know, this team and this community and this culture of Husky football and Husky basketball.
Right. Well, so that last thing you said is kind of the answer. So, you know, I did a season of basketball before I did a season of football. And when Dominic Green hit that shot against Arizona and that whole arena erupted the way that it did, that's when it just felt like real, like, okay, we're here and like we're part of this thing. And then of course that next year, you know, a wild football season that had its own adversity within that season. I mean, you know, that loss at Oregon was heartbreaking. And then the loss at Cal at the time made you think, okay, we're probably not going to go to the Rose Bowl this year. And yet they did. They just kept at it. They won out. They got the berth to the championship game, and then they beat Utah. And so just being a part of that ride and getting to meet, I mean, you know, it happens in stages, right? Like being a dog or not being a dog is not a just binary thing, right? Like, so it happens in stages. And so, like, I remember going to two nights before the Rose Bowl, going to the pep rally down there in LA and meeting some of the greats like Tui and Michael Jackson and some of these guys. It was just so cool to like really feel like, okay, like this is the feel for this place, to see how many people are traveling distances they don't travel back east. And other, you know, we're talking about all those folks going down to the Rose Bowl and being a part of it. Like, you don't see that because, you know, I think back east, like, if you were flying from Maine to Florida, you would consider that like, you know, a different part of the country. That's like an outrageously far thing. And yet there's this feel along the West Coast, even though it's a very long coast.
Yeah.
It's all kind of the same, you know,
kinda
obviously
connected, yeah.
Geographically and weather wise, it's different from Washington to Oregon to California, but there's still this feel of like, we're all West Coasters. Right. Yeah. So the West Coast presence that the Dogs have, I think just little things like that all the way along the way have made me feel more and more and more at home here at the UW. And then, you know, then this past year with moments like the Oregon game and even this past weekend against Washington State, then it really kind of hits home that like, yeah, I mean, we're all in this together, and it's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this Oregon game, or the Pac-12 championship game against Oregon on Friday. I mean, this is the Oregon Ducks, the hated rival. It's Nike versus Adidas, two second-year coaches in DeBoer and Lanning who have had tremendous success, two Heisman favorites who both transferred in from other schools last season, and then both decided to come back for an extra year and a chance to win a national championship and a Heisman in Penix and Nix. One team is 12-0. The other is 11-1, with its only loss being to the Huskies. And yet the Dogs, despite being 12-0, despite having beaten Oregon the last two times they faced each other, they come into this Pac-12 championship game as heavy underdogs, according to Vegas. Tony, I know you're doing a national broadcast of this game on Friday night. How do you paint the picture of the enormity of this final game of the Pac-12 conference for an audience that, you know, doesn't live and breathe dog or duck sports like we do?
Well, I think you just did a great job of it. So maybe we should just have you on the show. I think the thing is, it's not actually truly, it's available nationwide. It's available worldwide, right, with the internet, but it's still a local broadcast. So we're telling the Husky perspective and the Husky story for sure. And I think it's just, how do you tell that story? Just talking about the same things you were just talking about there. I mean, this is what this is. It's a 108-year-old conference with, you know, Washington's been a part of it the entire way. And it's a lot of tradition that's coming to an end in a way that's kind of sad. But we kind of talked about that sad stuff last week with the Apple Cup.
Yeah.
And now it's just about, okay, I think, in my opinion, Washington, Oregon is an elite college football rivalry in a way that Washington State is not.
No.
And I think it's evolved into an elite college football rivalry. Probably hasn't always been that way, but it's now, in my opinion, it's the best rivalry in the Western United States, west of Texas, Oklahoma. And I think it belongs in the conversation with Texas, Oklahoma, and Michigan, Ohio State, and Alabama, Auburn, and Florida State. And I think the reason it belongs is because of the enormity of the game, because and the national implications of it, because you don't get that with, you know, there are a lot of nice other rivalry, you know, Cal Stanford, you know, nice rivalry, a lot of tradition, cool moments. But you don't get that with that rivalry. This is different. This is Washington and Oregon, and two different just cultures, two different brands, two different academic institutions, two different football traditions. One is kind of old, one is kind of new, and both are playing for the same thing now. And that's what really makes it special. And so they're playing for the same thing, and they've had those swings of momentum in the rivalry too, which really makes it a rivalry, right? Because, I mean, there's nothing more painful, I think, to Husky fans than to even think about a 12-year stretch where they couldn't get one. Yeah. And yet at the same time, if you don't have that, then you don't have a rivalry. And so, and obviously I'm not advocating that happen again.
No, God forbid.
And it didn't have to happen to that extent. But without that, you don't have a rivalry. And Michigan, Ohio State has those. Alabama, Auburn has those. And so that's what I'm saying here is, like, now we're coming together at the same time for the first time over this last decade, over a sustained period of time. And I think, you know, we're getting ready for what's just the fourth ever Husky football game as a top five matchup. There's only been three others. And those were all bowl games. It was the CFP game against Alabama. It was the Orange Bowl against Oklahoma. It was the Rose Bowl against Michigan. That's it. Those are the only top five matchups in Husky football history. And now you're getting ready for a fourth, and it's against the team you like the least. And it's with everything at stake to try to get into one of those games, right? So it is I struggle to find the words other than to say it's ultimate. Right. Like it's the ultimate sort of circumstances you could hope for as a fan of a program. And you just got to relish it while it's here.
Absolutely. And, you know, talking about relishing it, there have been so many moments this season that are just, they're going to become just historic treasures in the archives of Husky history. The Huskies have only gone 12-0 two times in this storied program. Everybody knows 1991, the national championship season, 12-0. They finish with the victory over Michigan in the Rose Bowl. But to be honest, Tony, most of those games were not that close. They were blowouts by a very dominant Washington Husky team, in my
opinion.
That's
why Sports Illustrated was like, is this the greatest team ever, right?
Exactly. And you know, as somebody who grew up watching that team, you know, I definitely put them in the top 10 all-time greatest college football teams ever. This team has been different. These guys have been, the last 8 weeks or so, the cardiac kids of college football. They have had, you know, no game, I think, with a wider margin than 10 points over the last 8 weeks, including a thrilling victory over Oregon, the shootout with USC, a couple of extremely close calls with Stanford and ASU, and then just this past Saturday, a game that ended with a field goal winning kick by a walk-on kicker who earned a scholarship minutes later in the locker room. And Tony, you have been there to call all of those plays all season long. Just walk me through what that has been like for you to be the play-by-play announcer, you know, for not only a magical season, but for a season that has been, I mean, there have been more dramatic moments in this one year than probably most programs have over the course of a decade. So what has that been like for you as a play-by-play announcer?
Challenging. also really fun and really a blessing, because like you it is a dream job, and I don't want to say anything that would ever imply otherwise, but it's also a hard job when the games aren't close. Like it's hard to broadcast games that the interest in the building is just at zero, you know, and it's really, really, really hard when your team is on the losing end of those, right? So I think it's everybody's dream for all these games to be as close as they are. Who does what I do, because it's easy. Like I'm just trying to say what I see and to tell the stories of the great players and the coaches to the great fans, knowing that's who the whole thing's about. It's about the players, it's about the coaches, it's about the fans. And it's about connecting the players and coaches with the fans. It's about connecting them, right? And so it's just trying to be the conduit to that, and then being the same 6-year-old kid who just fell in love with college football, who just kind of like soaked it all in, and I feel like I got my soul calibrated to the sport enough to be able to put some things in perspective, right? So so that I can kind of be an avatar of those fans, right? Like since I'm the conduit, and I am a fan myself, I just try to, I try to just be, I try to think of what it's like to be those players and coaches. And then I try to think of what it's like to be a fan, and I try to just connect the two. And hopefully we do a decent enough job that the people can tell what's going on. You know, I mean, there's a little bit of a craft piece to it, that I fall back on just training when it comes to a lot of that stuff, which is calling a lot of high school games and stuff over the years, and just getting a lot of advice when trying to hone that craft. And some of the most memorable pieces of advice I've ever had were, never leave the audience asking a question, right? So like, you gotta, because they can hear everything else, you know. I think they can hear the stadium. And so if something that I'm saying doesn't match with what they're hearing in the stadium, they're going to start asking questions. Also, if they're just turning on the radio or the broadcast for the first time, they're going to be asking all the questions. Who's got the ball? Who's got the lead? What's been going on? All that stuff. So you try to, you know, from the craft standpoint, just do all those basics to check that box. And then I think the greatest broadcasters, my favorite broadcasters, have always been really good at knowing, like kind of the layers of an onion. You know, you can look at any moment through a lot of different layers. Are you looking at a moment for the play that it was, or are you looking at that play for the role that it played in the drive, or the role that it played in the quarter, or in the half, or in the game, or in the season, or in the history of the rivalry, or the history of the program, or the history of the sport? You know, like, so I think the really good ones have a good sense for that, and they can like get on the right level, whatever is required in a given moment. And sometimes that's really hard, because then from a word economy standpoint, you really only have 15 seconds to describe whatever it is. And that's why some of the best broadcasters of all time said the simplest things. What did everybody love about Bob Rondo? Touchdown, Washington. I mean, it's not reinventing the wheel. He's saying what happened, right? But it was good news, and he delivered it with such professionalism and gusto and celebration, and just sounded so good that told the story. That told you everything you needed to know. And then, you know, he had the clever one-liners on top of it. But I think that's the best I can answer. I'm just trying to be a conduit, and trying to be one of the millions out there in Husky Nation. That's we're all celebrating it together. And then just trying to do like the basic X's and O's of the job so that everybody can stay informed in the process.
I love it. I love it. And I went back and listened to some of your calls, and of course, one of the best moments was at the end of the Washington-Oregon game earlier this season. And I've got this written down in my notes. It's wide right. It's wide right. I don't believe it, Cam. I don't believe it. It's pandemonium at Husky Stadium. And I just, like, as I re-listened to that, I could just feel myself back in that moment, hugging everybody in purple around me, high-fiving strangers, you know, just laughing hysterically at the, you know, with joy in that moment. And I think every time I hear that call, I will just go back to that moment, looking down, seeing the kids one row in front of me that were both about 6 or 7 years old, wearing Michael Penix jerseys and doing the thumbs pointing at their back maneuver. I mean, it was just an all-time great, great moment. And I'm grateful that you got to make that call. And, you know, talking about Michael Penix, the last time you and I did this podcast, it was at the end of last season, and we were kind of making a last minute push to get Penix for, you know, the Heisman consideration, get him to New York City. It was a little bit too little too late for last year's campaign, but this year he came in as a Heisman favorite. He started off on a tear, but the last several weeks, the production has dropped a little bit. Last year, he averaged 357 yards passing a game. This year, he's down to 324. Right now, he's probably a little bit below Jaden Daniels and Bo Nix from a statistical standpoint, but he is the only quarterback of an undefeated team going into this championship weekend that's a Heisman candidate. Uh-huh. So talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about where you see Penix's Heisman, you know, chances going into this Friday's game, and maybe a little bit about the burden of being a Heisman candidate all year long, and perhaps how that has kind of weighed on a quarterback with all that pressure of being undefeated, going for a national championship, being the Heisman favorite from day one. What are your thoughts about the Penix for Heisman campaign in 2023?
Yeah, well, I think he is probably in the eyes of the country, sitting at number three-ish right now.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad place to be going into a game as big as this to wrap up the season. Because as everybody knows, the voting needs to be in on Monday. And nothing that happens during the bowl season is going to count toward the Heisman Trophy. It'll be given out by then. So for him to be at number three, I mean, you're in striking distance with an opportunity against a really good defense that ranks, you know, top 10 nationally and all these different metrics, to go out and make that last claim. And Jaden Daniels doesn't get the chance to do that this weekend for LSU. He's not playing. And then you're going up against the other guy, Bo Nix. So, you know, I think he's sitting in a good spot. I do think, you know, everything that we've heard, because Mike Penix has not been available to the media very much this year. I think, you know, he's had such an enormous responsibility on him. And I think one of the things that's like a really underrated responsibility now for guys like Mike is NIL, because so much of the money that he might be getting for NIL, he has to earn, you know, and this is now a third full-time job that a lot of these guys have to take on top of being a student and on top of being a football player. Yeah. And they are trying to keep the main thing, right? So like his responsibilities have been enormous. And I don't know. I can only speculate, but you know, I do have to wonder, like, with how successful he was with the deep ball to kind of get himself all this attention. Then as teams try to take that stuff away, has he been forcing it a little bit? You know, I don't know. I mean, it's I don't think he's become, you know, any less of a quarterback in the last 4 to 6 weeks. I think that teams have adjusted. He's played some games in difficult conditions and situations. And so, you know, I mean, I think the whole season has ebbs and flows to it. And that includes Heisman candidacy, right? And so now is his opportunity to go try to win it. And let's be really clear about something, because I know Husky Nation wants this so bad for him and for itself, and understandably, because Washington's never had a Heisman Trophy winner. There is no shame in not winning the Heisman Trophy.
Right.
Like, we're talking about one player out of how many, over 10,000 FBS college football players out there, that we're talking about the one who wins the most coveted award in all of college sports, maybe the most coveted individual award in sports.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for him to be in the conversation that he's been in, I know he's honored, and I know it comes with a huge burden and a lot of pressure to try to live up to that, to try to be the best in the country week after week after week. And has it been perfect? No, but I don't think it has to be. I think he's got to find a way to go get a really tough 13th win this weekend. And he said it himself in spring ball, and I thought it was so genuine, and I thought it was the best possible answer. He was asked by a reporter, hey, you know, you're kind of like number two behind Caleb Williams on the early Heisman, you know, projections right now. Is that interesting to you? And he just shot back so genuinely. He's like, I'm interested in winning a national championship, and whatever comes with that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's there. And now it's like, all right, like, what would you rather do this weekend? Would you rather go win the Heisman Trophy and lose the game? Or would you rather win the game and not get the Heisman Trophy? I guarantee you Mike would rather win the game and not get the Heisman Trophy. And even if he does get the Heisman Trophy, he's going to be the first person to tell you he couldn't have done it without the offensive line and without Roma Dunze and Jalen Polk and Jalen McMillan and Jeremy Bernard and all those guys anyway. So I just think he's got the right mindset to best position himself. And if it happens, it's going to be special. And if it doesn't, there's no shame in that whatsoever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one more question before we wrap up, but you mentioned Roma Dunze, and you know, going back to 2016, Jake Browning, who, by the way, threw a touchdown to another former Washington Husky, Drew Sample, over the weekend on the Cincinnati Bengals. So that was a special moment. But Jake Browning was named the Pac-12 Offensive Player of the Year. Interestingly, though, on the team, John Ross was named the offensive player for the team. And I don't think that was a slight at all to Jake Browning, but I think it was a recognition that John Ross was such a significant contributor to the success that Browning had had. And I think you could see a similar type of, you know, presentation of those two ideas in this year's, you know, class with Roma Dunze really emerging as the number one receiver out of this really dynamic trio of McMillan and Polk and Odunze. So just talk a little bit about what Odunze has accomplished this year. Has he won the Biletnikoff? Does he need to do something still to seal the deal? And does he deserve to be in the Heisman conversation as well?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the thing is, everybody knows that these awards, a lot of it is based on hype generated by a mega media machine. And, you know, I just have a hard time the way that people talk about Marvin Harrison Jr. I have a hard time believing that, you know, the college football powers that be are going to change their mind. Like, I don't think there's anything Rome could do. Like, Rome's 128 yards away from breaking Reggie Williams' single season receiving record, which is a record I thought would never fall.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so absurd, ridiculous, 1,454 receiving yards in a season. And in the same number of games, by the way, Rome just needs 128 to break that, which he had 128 in the first game against Oregon. Exactly. So we'll see if he does that. But, you know, like when you say, does someone deserve Heisman conversation? It always feels like there's about 100 people who deserve Heisman conversation. And yet you can only put like three or four in the mix, right? Like,
right.
It's an extremely elite club. So, again, I don't think there's any shame in saying like, hey, it might not happen.
Right.
But here's what I would say to those who think Marvin Harrison should / will win the Biletnikoff. Just the same way, because they're so enamored with the tape that he puts out, and they consider him a generational talent, and they think that he's going to make a great pro.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't agree with any of that.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think all of that's perfectly fine. I would say, just the same way that the Heisman Trophy does not go to the number one draft pick, because it's about more than that, I would say it'd be the same thing for wide receivers with the Biletnikoff. And mm-hmm. I don't think you could argue that any player at the wide receiver position has had more of an impact on his team and on the season of college football that we're all dealing with in December than Rome Odunze. I think that, you know, Jackson Smith and Jigba didn't play on that Ohio State team last year due to all these injury problems, and Ohio State was still Ohio State.
Right.
And I think you could take Marvin Harrison off that Ohio State team, and they still would have had a very similar looking season to what they had, probably 11-1. Lost to Michigan, whatever. I think if you take Rome Odunze off this team, might have a hard time with the Huskies not only being 12-0, but even being, you know, I think there's two or three games where he pushed them over the edge. And then if those games don't go Washington's way, you're talking about a different conference for the Pac-12. Oregon might not look as impressive as they do. The conference might not be talked about the way that it is. And the teams that are vying for a playoff spot could be different. Rome Odunze changed that.
Yeah.
And I think he's the most impactful wide receiver in college football. And I think he should win the Biletnikoff.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, I think it's about so much more than statistics. It's about so much more than,
which is a huge part of it. And speed. Rome's got those.
Yeah. Speed and size. I mean, yeah. Rome is equal with the top candidates on all those things, but I don't think that there's another candidate that you could even begin to compare with Rome Odunze when it comes to the wins above
about,
replacement.
Like, the
you
hype
know?
Machine. The hype machine, like, so Fox put out a tweet during the Ohio State Penn State game that just said generational talent.
Yeah.
And it was a Marvin Harrison touchdown. And I don't even disagree that he's a generational talent. He's an elite wide receiver. But he caught a shallow cross in open space and ran untouched to the pylon for like an 18-yard touchdown
right.
to give Ohio State the lead. And it's like, that's the highlight. Like, have you seen Rome's catches this year?
Yeah.
Have you seen that one with the guy draped all over him against Washington State? Did you see what he did to that Oregon DB in the corner to go win the game? Like, did you? Like, it's not even close. Like, and again, it's not to say Harrison couldn't make those plays. He could. But Rome did it. With the season on the line time and time again. And so he should win the award.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Tony, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm not going to ask you for a game score prediction because I am just going to believe that in your heart of hearts, you know the Dogs are going to pull this thing out and keep this magical season. But just know that all of Husky Nation is grateful for you. We love the way that you pour your heart and soul and your gifts and abilities into giving us the best play-by-play calls across the country. And thank you so much for being a part of this podcast with me. Take care of that voice, drink that honey and tea and lemon and all that good stuff. And look forward to having you back on the show in the future.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks, Warren. Go Dawgs.
Go Dawgs. Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Dawg and Duck Show. My name is Warren. I am the Dawg, and with me, I have one of the greatest Husky quarterbacks of all time, Steve Pelure. Steve, thank you for joining us and welcome to the Dawg and Duck Show.
Thanks, Warren. It's an honor to be here.
Well, for many people, there's no introduction needed, but Steve, going back to your time as a Husky, you really did some remarkable things. You were a multiple year starter, offensive player of the year in the Pac-10, led the Huskies to a Rose Bowl berth, and had a record for a while, I believe, of 137 passes without an interception, which was pretty remarkable, and then went on to have a great NFL career and be a part of just an epic line of Husky quarterbacks who succeeded in college and in the NFL. So tell us a little bit about what this has been like for you to see what Michael Penix has done over these last couple of years as a Husky quarterback, being a quarterback yourself. Just give me your thoughts about Michael Penix and the job he's done for these Washington Huskies.
I mean, to me, the feeling I get is relating to what he's doing in our team now. It seems to me like what I was doing in college was like peewee football compared to what they're doing now. I mean, I have no idea how they even call these plays now. I don't have any idea how they shift around, you know, 2, 3, 4 times. You know, how do you call that? Like, we didn't even have the shotgun in college. You know, when I went to Dallas, you know, they were kind of the innovators of the shotgun. And so, you know, in college we were under center all the time, and Coach James, you know, he would only let me throw the ball in 2 minutes if I was lucky. So, I mean, it was, you know, run first down, second down, third down, and, you know, throw it only if you have to. So
yeah,
it's amazing to me what they do, what these receivers are able to do, the back shoulder throws to, you know, Adunze and McMillan and just our offensive line, how they've protected him. I mean to be top in the nation or up in the top of the nation in terms of sacks, I mean, it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, I'm just every time I watch, I'm just in awe. I mean, I wasn't in as much awe in the Apple Cup as I was, you know, at the beginning of the season, but you know, I think they've struggled, and I think, you know, they don't have as good a weather the last couple of games. So I don't think people realize how tough it is for them to stay as focused as they were early in the season.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, you've played at the highest level. You had success as a sophomore. And then, you know, your senior year, you really, you know, put it all together and had a tremendous final season. And I'm sure that there were some times where you felt, you know, pressure in some of these games. And yet, you know, when I listened to and watched the video for your Husky Hall of Fame, you know, induction, one of the things that the guy said was that you kept the mood really light in the huddle, and that You let them feel like, hey, we're just out there playing some backyard football. And then if you needed to kind of command the attention of the room, you had the ability to do that. But how do you kind of balance those types of emotions of, hey, we've got to give our best effort, we've got to be totally locked in, and yet not become overwhelmed by the size of the moment?
I mean, you know, it wasn't really until late in my career where I really felt like I could totally play with freedom and just understanding, like, it's not all on me. All I have to do is my job. I just got to get the ball to the playmakers, you know? And I think if you have that mentality, you know, it's easier to kind of take that pressure off your shoulders. But I carried a ton of weight when I was in college. I remember my junior year, I mean, we go into Stanford, we were ranked number one in the nation. I was just feeling so much pressure. Like, I got to do this. I got to win this game. I got to, you know, it's, and when you're so focused on yourself, you know, it's tough to be a good teammate and play with freedom. And so I think that's, you know, what I think Mike Penix has done so well is he's been able to take all his skills and get the ball to the playmakers. I am concerned that he's taken too much on himself. In fact, I'm wondering if at the Apple Cup, when his, you know, head was down after the game and then he put the coat over, if it was just kind of releasing a lot of the pressure that he even felt, you know, I have no idea what he was feeling, but I feel that guy cares so much. And I think he's carrying, you know, I think that's probably a lot of some of their struggles in the last couple of games is he wants so badly to help his team and lead. And I think he is carrying a ton of pressure.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you probably would have a perspective that few people do, having been a quarterback at the University of Washington. Like you said, coming into a game, feeling the pressure being number one in the country. And, you know, Don James is obviously the greatest head coach in UW history. He's got the statue out in front of the stadium for a reason. He was a great coach. Also, actually spoke at Impact Players, which is an organization that I lead, several years ago before he passed away. And but now Kalen DeBoer has taken over, and I'm sure that you may be able to draw some similarities, but also some unique differences between the two, because you had the opportunity to play for Don James. Your son Zeke had the opportunity to play under the great Chris Peterson, Jimmy Lake, and then in Kalen DeBoer's first season. So give me a little bit of your perspective of what Kalen DeBoer has done and any similarities or differences between him and what Don James was able to do during his successful tenure.
I think what I really have enjoyed about Kalen DeBoer is just his desire to see the players lead. And I think that was, I don't think Coach James really was as good as at doing that until later in his career. I think he seemed to loosen up later in his career and let the players lead a little bit more. When I was there, you know, he would stand up on his tower at practice and just would not, you know, he always seemed to have a frown on his face. And only time he talked to me was when, you know, he was yelling at me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, is not something that, you know, I have real fond memories of it because he was just an intimidating factor. You know, you're almost playing out of fears because he knew he was watching you. Whereas I think he loosened up over the years and was more engaging with especially the captains. But I really feel like DeBoer's mantra is, you know, great teams are player led. And I totally buy into that. And I think he really fosters that. He really encourages the players to take the lead. And so I really like that. I didn't really get that close to Jimmy Lake. So I don't know that much about, you know, him and his style, but, you know, I think Coach James was kind of old school, kind of in the Nick Saban deal where there's this, you know, intimidation factor a little bit, but I don't see that with Coach DeBoer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Steve, I know that you come from a family that has a lot of Cougs in the heritage, and yet you became a Dog. So I can only assume that the Apple Cup has had special meaning to you for many years. And of course, this being the last Apple Cup this past Saturday in the history of the series as it relates to the Pac-12, what was it like for you to play in the Apple Cup, to see your son play in the Apple Cup, and to just then witness this final, you know, showdown between the Huskies and the Cougars this past Saturday?
It's been crazy. I mean, it just seems like every Apple Cup that I've been involved in has been just seems to have become such an important game, like in terms of making the Rose Bowl or, you know, something happening. I mean, my freshman year, you know, the Cougars had a chance to knock us off and they were ahead at halftime. And I saw my mom in the stands. She was taunting me because she's a Coug. She's saying, "Hey, look at the scoreboard, pal." And I was like, "Are you kidding me? You know, your son is here and you're taunting him because you're a Coug fan."
That's hilarious.
And then, you know, my sophomore year, I was, you know, super young, scared, spitless, and, you know, playing in Husky Stadium and just in a windy, crazy game that we ended up winning, and that launched us into the Rose Bowl. And then my junior year, losing to the Cougs to kick us out of the Rose Bowl in an upset in Pullman. And then my senior year is when I felt the most pressure, just because, you know, I had had such a great senior season and we had another chance to go to the Rose Bowl and they knocked us out again. So, you know, if it wasn't for the Cougs, I would have been to four straight Rose Bowls, you know, and that would have been, so anyway, I look back on it with a lot of fond memories, but a lot of agony as well.
It sounds that way. You know, it's pretty serious when mom is giving you grief on the sidelines.
That is for sure. You don't expect that.
You know, did that continue with Zeke, with your kids?
No, I mean, I think, although I think my mom in the Apple Cup last year, his last year, I think she would have been fine if the Cougars would have won.
Yeah.
You know, she's not, you know, I've got other members of the family that are a little bit more rabid than my mom. So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's great. I love it. Well, you know, as we turn our attention to this Friday, the Huskies have what could be arguably the biggest and most important and consequential game in the entire history of the Pac-12. The 12-0 Washington Huskies going up against the 11-1 Oregon Ducks in the Pac-12 championship game. Winner gets into the college football playoffs. The loser most likely is out. The winner is going to have on some level, eternal bragging rights for the Pac-12, as this is the final game in the history of the conference. So as you think about just the meaning of this game, what would it mean to you as a former Husky to see the Dogs go out of the Pac-12 on top as the champions, 13-0 in the final year of the Pac-12?
Oh, it would be epic if they could win this. I mean, it really would. I mean, what a testament to those kids and the coaches. I mean, just to what they've accomplished. And you know, they set high goals. So, you know, that they were planning on this, and to see it unfold has been incredible. I mean, and I think what makes it so special for Huskies is that, you know, we were just dominated by the Ducks for, you know, it seemed like almost a decade, you know, when Chip Kelly was there. And it was just so painful to get hammered by the Ducks. And I know we had our years prior to Chip Kelly, but, you know, to be back at the same level and to beat them the last couple of years, I think just has, I don't know, it's been such a great feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can imagine just feelings of pure elation. By the way, I didn't look this up before we did this podcast, but did you ever lose to the Ducks during your time as a Husky quarterback?
I did not. No, we won every game. I think my senior year was we played up here and it was fairly close. Okay. Actually, no, we played down there because I had a 60-yard run in Autzen Stadium that hopefully is going to stand as the longest quarterback run there. I'm not sure if it is.
That's pretty cool. Well, Steve, I may be wrong on this, but I believe that there are three Husky quarterbacks who have won the Pac-10 or Pac-12 Offensive Player of the Year and won a Rose Bowl. And it's you, Warren Moon, and Marcus Tuiasosopo. I would say that's pretty good company.
Wow, that is pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it has been fantastic being able to chat a little Husky football with you. Any final thoughts for our Dog and Duck listeners as we wrap this thing up?
You know, I think they're going to win. I do. I mean, I know most everybody doesn't, but I like that the fact that we're an underdog. I just think we play better as underdogs. We played better last year as underdogs. You know, when people aren't expecting them, I think they're more focused. I think they're going to keep drives alive. I'm excited to see what happens.
Well, Husky Nation is excited with you, Steve. For all my Dog fans out there, go Dogs. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Warren.
Husky Nation, it's the end of the third quarter. Are you looking for the perfect tequila for your next get-together? The answer is Born from a Hero, Hero de Leon. Direct from the prestigious Murguia family, just outside Guadalajara, honoring their great-grandfather who saved Mexico from a horrible civil war. It's authentic, courageous, with great integrity, just like the general. Enjoy the smoothest Blanco tequila you've ever tasted, or the rich flavor of our Reposado, aged for 7 months in American bourbon barrels. Or the ultimate tequila, our Añejo, which is aged for 18 months in the same bourbon oak barrels. Go to your favorite liquor retailer or restaurant and ask for Hero de Leon, because it's always the end of the third quarter. Imported by Zombie Beverages, Mercer Island, Washington.